How's everyone this morning? This is a bit like writing the book all over again, you know. The section we've come to now about the forces of darkness turned out to be very interesting, you know, because I think all of us, we've kind of discounted it. We always look at the light and don't look at the dark side. We remember the quotation that says, you know, that evil is really doesn't exist, just the absence of good, and kind of discounted on that basis. But I found these marvelous quotations of the Guardians that we have to be fully aware, you know, we're not ignorant and stupid. We have to look at these forces of darkness, and we have to consciously try to rid ourselves of the influence of them in our own lives so that we can then assist others to escape from them in the future, and that they're very real. In the absence of light, they are everything. So it's a question of identifying them. And sometimes, you know, when people talk about dark forces, especially now with all the vampire movies and everything, they get the wrong idea about evil forces being something that you can't control at all and you don't know where they come from and you're just a victim. But this is not the case according to these definitions of the Guardian, which have been collected through all of his writings. I think you've seen the first of them. I had them in a list, but they looked a little formidable in a list. So on page 63, we find that among the forces of darkness identified by the Guardian are conditions that appear in humanity when it turns away from God. So we've kind of made categories of them here. And he mentions irreligion, atheism, naturalism, unbelief, secularism, and paganism. Other dark forces named by Shoghi Effendi are what a wayward humanity worships in place of God: materialism, nationalism, racialism, and communism. He conveys the perversions of religion with another set of terms, among them being fanaticism and superstition. Still other dark forces are the consequences of humanity's losing the moral compass provided by living religion. These include prejudice, corruption, immorality, moral laxity, widespread lawlessness. Dark forces, he likewise states, include elements which accelerate the decline of humanity's fortunes, such as violence, disorder, rebellion, revolt, anarchy, disunity, inharmony, separation, schism, disintegration, hatred, suspicion, despair, reaction, and decay. These are the dark forces, whether they are expressed individually in our lives or collectively in the cultures and societies that surround us. They mislead us and keep us from turning to the world of God. Then in contrast to these, hardly need mentioning, but it's good for us to review them, we have the forces of light. And these include forces that derive directly from authentic religions, such as justice, trustworthiness, compassion, faith, interdependence, universality, insight, godliness, wisdom, rectitude, holiness, and peace. And along with these come the ones that are so closely related to our connection with God, such as love, unity, harmony, purity, consideration, courage, courtesy, and humility. There are others that are the outcome of faith and obedience to the divine teachings, such as happiness, detachment, acquiescence, magnanimity, integrity, truthfulness, sagacity, uprightness, moderation, chastity, trust, and hope. Yet others are the conditions that will heal the world, in the broader sense, reconciliation, pacification, integration, orderliness, fellowship, nonviolence, and freedom for prejudice. Now, these are just, of course, a partial list. You'll be able to compile your own as you think about them, and surely you should think about them. And then it comes down to the one that's mentioned most by the Guardian in his writings, is irreligion and materialism. He says that materialism is the greatest enemy of the faith. We've got lots of enemies, but he says materialism is the greatest enemy of the faith. Why is that? Because it invades the human soul and destroys and kills any desire for spirituality, making it seem irrelevant, unimportant, nothing that can really help us in our life in this society we live in. This is another emphasis that you'll find over and over in the writings of the Guardians. The cultural tendencies, the milieu in which we've grown up and developed, we've absorbed from those around us, from our schooling, from the magazine culture that we live in. Shoghi Effendi went on and on about this magazine culture. He says that nothing's treated except superficially. Books and things, okay, they goes into depth, and there's thoughtfulness, there's intelligence, and so on. But most of the magazines are just quick overview and very focused on pleasures and so on. How to perceive how much these things have influenced us in the way we think and the way we react is the challenge that we have to face. And there's quite a bit in the book about that. I can't go into it too much at length, but Shoghi Effendi certainly in his quotations, in the quotations that we've cited here, talks about this. He says, for instance, early on in his ministry, "We have but to turn our eyes to the world without to realize the fierceness and the magnitude of the forces of darkness that are struggling with the dawning light of the Abha revelation. Nations, though exhausted and disillusioned, have seemingly begun to cherish anew the spirit of revenge, of domination and strife. Peoples convulsed by economic upheavals are slowly drifting into two great opposing camps," because this was before the Great Cold War, "with all their menace of social chaos, class hatreds, and worldwide ruin. Races alienated more than ever before are filled with mistrust, humiliation, and fear, and seem to prepare themselves afresh for a fresh and fateful encounter. Creeds and religions caught in this whirlpool of conflict and passion appear to gaze with impotence and despair at this spectacle of unceasing turmoil." The Guardian, in this sense, when he was talking about it, said that communism and capitalism were twin sisters, because both of them, at the heart, worship the acquisition of material goods and material prosperity. And somehow we have to rid ourselves of that and put another set of values in their place. And with the rat race that's around us, it's confusing sometimes and very challenging. And very challenging to our children, who are living in that in a much more complete way than we are as adults, who are discussing and reading from the writings and things like that. And one has to, I think, consider that a great deal in raising children, how to give them a picture of what's going on without being too critical and negative of it, but at the same time giving them spiritual values and instilling in them the love for the faith, the love of God, and admiration and appreciation for what religion brings. And that requires us to go back really and look again: if irreligion is the problem, what is religion? And we have so many beautiful passages in the writings and summaries from Shoghi Effendi in different parts of his writings, in the World Order Letters, in the Promised Day Has Come, where he talks about that. What are the key points of religion? And they're definitely worth collecting and thinking about, meditating on. There's many passages in the tablets revealed after the Actas about the true nature of religion. Again, we tend to inherit a view of religion from the culture around us, and even though we know, yes, as Baha'is, we need religion more than on Sunday, but we tend to go back to that point of view, you know, that I have to live my life. The old saints of bygone ages used to talk about, you can do your work in the shadow or you can do it out in the sunlight. For instance, if you're supposed to be opening peas out of their pods, you can sit in the sunlight to do it, or you can sit in the shade. But it's just kind of a simple example of, if we can, through our prayers and our meditations in the morning, bring to our lives something of the light of the faith, and hold it and return it and refresh it in our day, even though we're doing complicated other matters. In fact, Abdu'l-Bahá talks about how the powers of the spirit can actually assist the soul in complicated. The affairs of the cause are run by spiritual impulses too. so many complicated things that have to be worked out that if you had to do it all on your own, it's too much, smart as you may be. So the question then is to how to infuse our lives with the forces of light. And of course, that's the thing that makes us appealing. That's the thing that makes us magnetic in character, that attracts the hearts of waiting souls to us. Well, this is our big task. I mean, we can see how many people that we talk to and we touch don't react to the faith in the way we would hope they would. But there are a percentage of waiting souls. And I think that the number of those is increasing in the world because of the chaos around us and the suffering that people are encountering. And so in our lives, when it says we want to defeat these forces of darkness, we want to think about teaching, we want to think about reaching receptive souls with the cause. It's a shortcut if we pray in the morning. Mr. Sears used to say this a lot. He says, if we pray in the morning, God, help me to find waiting souls in the course of the day, in the course of my normal activities. And then give me the good grace to recognize which ones are the waiting souls, because, you know, God puts us in the way of people, and we doubt. Sri Aurobindo says we should never try to decide ourselves how receptive people are going to be to the faith. That they oftentimes surprise us, that people who we think aren't ready actually are ready and respond in ways that we didn't expect. So our task is, of course, propagating these forces of light, carrying them forward. And Shoghi Effendi talks about how we have to purge out of ourselves the influence of the forces of darkness before we can manage it to do the job with someone else and with the masses around us. So this is our challenge, is to examine ourselves, to see the degrees to which we find ourselves all unconsciously under the influence of a false world picture, of a false vision of what life is for, of how we measure the values of what we do with our time and our energies, all these things that it comes down to what Baha'u'llah says, to bring thyself to account each day. Now, you can't bring yourself to account if you don't know what the account requires. You have to know what the teachings are. And then it's comparing yourselves against that. And the Bab says that we should do this morning and evening. And he says, if you find that you've been assisted to do something that is good pleasure to God, then you praise God for that and you thank him for having fortified you and strengthened you to be able to do such a thing. And if you find that you've done just the opposite and you've engaged in things that you shouldn't engage in at all, you ask his forgiveness and ask him strength to be able to face these in a new way and overcome the weak tendencies that you have in your nature. All of us have them. If you're not perfect, you're actually fulfilling a statement of Abdu'l-Bahá that he says, this is not a world of perfections. So don't get too excited about it when you find that you haven't reached absolute perfection yet. Remember that that's part of the description of this lower world of nature. But certainly he does insist we engage in the struggle. And struggle means sometimes you'll fall down, and sometimes, you know, it's like when the movies, the hero goes in the fight, he always is losing for a while, and then he gradually comes up. And I think that's kind of like the Baha'i picture too, you know. You feel like you're never going to get out of the influence of some things, and yet they gradually subside. Dr. Getzinger was talking to Abdu'l-Bahá in the Holy Land about this one time. And Abdu'l-Bahá said that God sends the tests that we need to us. And he said, we fail them. And then we think we can face them ourselves, and we try to resolve them, we try to change. And they come back again, and we see that we failed. Until finally we're so miserable in our failure that we fall at his feet and we supplicate and beg him, I now see I cannot defeat these things, these shortcomings I have, that only you can lift them from me. Please, I beg you, lift you. You know, when you get to that really sincere point where you use the power of the prayers and you use the power of leaning on him, He lifts them from you. Then Abdu'l-Bahá says he sends the same test again, and you pass it, and you realize it's overcome. And you didn't make a big effort, except in those prayers and in the sincerity of your approach to him, to overcome that. Like the peeling, like the surface of an onion, you get rid of one thing, and there's the next major challenge that you usually know what they are. In fact, usually the major challenge is the one we don't want to deal with. I think, oh God, I'll get to that, but just give me a little bit of space for that one. You know, it's a hard thing to detach myself of this particular issue, but I'll work on this one. No, he sends the one, because there's a certain ordering, there's a certain priority in the way we have to get rid of our lower nature, so to speak, and we usually know which is the main issue to deal with in ourselves, and we need to address it. And usually it's that one that we can't address by ourselves, that we have to ask his help. Abdu'l-Bahá says, when it's too difficult, he says, lean on me. And a wonderful tablet. The master is there to lean on, besides Baha'u'llah. So if you've been to the Holy Land and been in the shrines, you realize that this terrific, overwhelming power of the shrine of the Bab, it's just, you know, awesome, you're awestruck. And then you go in the master's shrine and somehow he's the loving father and he commiserates with you and you understand and you can lean on him and hold to him, give me strength and give me guidance to how do I deal with this power, this awe-inspiring power and force of the revelation of the Bab. And of course, then there's this great serenity and peace of Baha'u'llah's shrine that usually you've come to the shrines on Mount Carmel first, and you go there. Although in the future, the Guardian said it would be the opposite. People will first go to the shrine of Baha'u'llah and then come to the shrine of the Bab and Abdu'l-Bahá. Okay, forces of darkness, moving on. How do we rid ourselves? How do we even understand the inherited cultural outlooks that are derived from the darkness around us? This needs reading the writings, it needs lots of meditation. Shoghi Effendi has stated that the dark forces are part of the fabric of the societies in which we have grown up. Aspects of life they normally don't even question, because we've inherited them, and that's the way everybody looks at life. And the wonderful thing about being Baha'is, and particularly, I think this is true with relation to pioneering, is you suddenly go out in the world and see different cultures and see different ways of looking at things. And you realize how plastic human nature is, and plastic in the sense of flexible, how it can adapt itself to so many different situations. And what we thought was the human condition isn't the human condition. It was our local California condition, or whatever it happens to be, you know, Hollywood, as where I came from. Gradually, it gets home to you that there are certain things that you thought were permanent values that don't have anything to do with permanence at all. And that's the kind of sifting that we need to do. I like to think that we start off in a kind of a murk, an inherited murk in our consciousness. And through the salts, through the minerals of the words of God, that murk gradually gets clarified, and finally it crystallizes in such a way that it becomes both the reflector and the refractor of light, of the light of the revelation. This is now a stage that I think we can see mentioned in the writings, that the soul rises up to see with the eye of God and hear with his ear. And surely this must mean that seeing the world in the way that Baha'u'llah indicates we should see it. So central to that would be the hidden words. And Abdu'l-Bahá calls on us to memorize the hidden words. And I think I mentioned earlier that he says if you manage to live one of those hidden words, you will have lived all of them. They're all connected with each other. And that's probably the greatest remedy for getting your eye changed or renovated, so to speak, so that you do see the way Baha'u'llah wants you to see. And if you find yourself thinking that, as this sometimes came up with the youth, that the laws of the faith are too strict and the world is here and the laws of the faith are here and the world is here, and he does, after all, say moderation. So I'll position myself in the middle somewhere here, you know. This is between hot and cold, and it's lukewarm. And I think there's some phrases in the Bible that says, and the Lord will spew the word lukewarm out of his mouth. So moderation is not somewhere halfway between the world and what the faith says. Moderation is what Baha'u'llah says. Now, if you want to go further than what Baha'u'llah says, well, that's your business, but that would be in moderation. But if you stick to what Baha'u'llah says, you'll be in the moderate position. As much as that may not seem moderation to you at certain points in your life, dealing with certain of these admonitions and calls that he gives. There's this quotation from the Guardian where he says there are two kinds of Baha'is, those whose religion is Baha'i and those who live for the faith. Needless to say, if we can belong to the latter category, if one can be in the vanguard of heroes, martyrs, and saints, it is more praiseworthy in the sight of God. And we see how people kind of come into the faith. Some of them come in and they're all on fire from the very beginning, but others come in and they love it. I love this religion, it's a wonderful religion, but just haven't quite made it to the faith, to the place where the faith is their life and not only their religious. And that's also a problem because of what we consider the role of religion to be, so that we're not considered fanatic or out of touch with the people around us, or so many explanations that we give. In one of the letters of the Guardian, he says, we know the absence of light is darkness, but no one would assert that darkness was not a fact. It exists even though it is only in the absence of something else. So evil exists too, and we cannot close our eyes to it, even though it is a negative existence. We must seek to supplant it by good. And if we see an evil person is not influenceable by us, then we should shun his company, for it is unhealthy. You know the hidden words where he talks about that. Association with the righteous cleanses the rust from off the heart, and association with the ungodly just leads to your destruction. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try to teach the ungodly, to give them a chance. I think the master says twice, try twice to see. And then if you don't influence them by that time, then probably they will start influencing you. So you have to think what you're doing. There are dark forces, he says, in the world today of despair and hatred and suspicion. The believers must, as the master said, turn their backs on these and their faces to him, confident of his help and protection. And of course, we have the prayers and pray for all these things. Again, the Guardian said in 1952, we've been told over and over again in the teachings that the forces of darkness attack Baha'is. And it is these forces which are seeking to disrupt your national body. He doesn't say which national body. I mean, he does, but it's not in the compilation. It is more important than individual feelings or side-taking. Now, you could substitute very well for this your local body as well as your national body. It is the disruptive, dark, evil powers let loose in the world through the godlessness of humanity that through the human weakness of Baha'is breaks forth into assemblies and often into communities and seeks to destroy the constructive things that the Baha'is are striving to accomplish. In another place, he says that we should beware lest we think or feel negatively about others. First time I read that, I thought, what? How is that possible? You know, okay, I don't talk negatively, except under great precaution, about others. I mean, people who, you know, I know, and I know they understand the difficulties of this other person. But to not think or feel negatively, he says, lest through that action, you allow dark forces into your soul. Well, that gets frightening, really. How much time we would save if we didn't go on and on in our heads about how bad so-and-so is, or how I've been offended by such and such. We just waste a terrific amount of energy on those things. And if those are the sources of darkening our spirits, how much more we want to avoid it. There's a few of these passages is so important. The believers, he says, to better understand their own internal condition should realize that the forces of darkness in the world are so prevalent and strong that their morbid and turbulent influence is felt by all. They should therefore consciously strive to be more loving, more united, more dedicated and prayerful than ever before, in order to fight against the atmosphere of present-day society, which is unloving, disunited, careless of right and wrong, and heedless of God. What a standard he's setting for us to arise, and how the mere intention, to have the intention to go in this direction, attracts confirmations, attracts blessings to us, and enables us to hold up the standard that God is asking of us. It's not easy, you're not going to do it all alone, but by leaning on the Master and constantly refreshing our vision of the faith, we can stage by stage increase our awareness of these things. Finally, he says the friends must at all times bear in mind that they are, in a way, like soldiers under attack. The world is at present in an exceedingly dark condition spiritually. Hatred and prejudice of every sort are literally tearing it to pieces. We, on the other hand, are the custodians of the opposite forces, the forces of love, of unity, of peace, and integration. And we must continually be on our guard, whether as individuals or as an assembly or community, lest through us these destructive negative forces enter into our midst. In other words, we must beware lest the darkness of society become reflected in our acts and attitudes, perhaps all unconsciously. Love for each other, the deep sense that we are a new organism, the dawnbreakers of a new world order, must constantly animate our Baha'i lives. And we must pray to be protected from the contamination of society, which is so diseased with prejudice. How to change our lives spiritually is a great challenge to us all, I think. Especially maybe we've been Baha'is for a long time and we've kind of settled into the way we are as Baha'is. The last 10 years since 95, with the various directives coming from the Universal House of Justice about activities in Baha'i communities and where our focus should be, I think is uprooted a lot of old concepts in the Baha'is, and some of the Baha'is have kind of gone quiet and said, well, I can't struggle with this, I can't figure it out, I can't struggle with it. Others have gone forward with it. New ones have become zealous to the point of injuring the rest of us. So it's all a part of a process, but it makes us have to re-examine, and we should study very carefully the words of the House of Justice in its messages and its letters. These were crafted under the inspiration of the House of Justice in session, word by word, believe me, word by word, adjective by adjective. And the guidance is all there. And anything that's not there is not the guidance, wherever it comes from. So that's, you know, I went back to after being here in California and traveling around the states and met as a member of the House of Justice with it and talked about certain things I'd seen. And over and over, the House would say, that's not in the message of the House of Justice. I don't know where it's come from, but it's not in the message of the House of Justice. Tell the friends to cite the messages of the House of Justice. Study the messages of the House of Justice. So if you get agitated because someone or even a member of some institution tells you something that doesn't seem quite right to you, go back to the messages of the House of Justice and you will be healed of the problem. You will understand. And then you can pray for patience to put up with the situation the way it is until it changes. So sometimes that happens to us too. We want to have our best energies ready to look for seeking souls, for waiting souls, and really that's the most important aspect of what we're doing. But we also want to increase the manpower available to do those things. And that's what this process is basically about. I must say we're impressed wherever we're going with the nature of devotional meetings. You know, I used to talk to people about the faith, and they say yes, and they say, oh, you do have meetings I can come to? Well, sometimes we have a fireside, a fireside, you know, if they don't know what you're talking about, like campfires or something. What you, or we say, well, there is another, what's the feast? And you're, it's a secret meeting. You're not allowed to come to that. It was a little bit too turned in on itself, you know, and we talked about this in Haifa, how we have to make some core activities that will attract people on a regular basis, that they'll feel free, that the community of interest will feel free to mix with the Baha'is in a way until some of them need time to identify with the cause. It's too sudden just bringing them to a 19-day feast. So they have all these other options now. And so many Baha'i parents have been, or non-Baha'i parents have been attracted through the children's classes, through the children tell each other and they want to go to the classes, the parents say yes, and then they see the changes starting to take place in their children and want to know what the source of that is, the influence of that is. Now, we saw that all in Latin America, Marilyn and I, when we were there serving, how important it was. The consolidation of masses all oftentimes was very dependent on children's classes. People are all interested that their kids can somehow be better than they are and understand things. And so that becomes an important element, an important core activity. The devotionals everywhere are very flexible in character. And some of them are actually firesides dressed up as devotionals. But that happened for a while until the house put a line in where it says that firesides are certainly an acceptable activity because we've been told they weren't for a while. And that seemed to contradict the Guardian, and people were terribly confused. So those things have resolved themselves, I think, and surely the form of the devotional quasi-fireside method where people ask about the faith after the prayers and get into discussions about the teachings gradually leads them to the cause and is a natural source for the institute process. And for new people, oftentimes, sitting quietly reflecting on these passages of the Ruhi books is a way of calming them down after the life that they've been leaving. Particularly this first book that talks about prayer and about life after death seems to connect universally with the spirit of the people that are coming to think. And nobody claims that the Ruhi books are perfect, but they do fulfill a role in this transitional period that we're in, and I don't know for how long. And there's going to be more of them, and as the series progresses, they get I think they get meatier and heavier in their content. More texts are quoted, and so on. But as I was saying previously, to study the writings is something that is not fulfilled just by the Ruhi course. You have to go to the writings, the original writings themselves, and progressively, painstakingly, as the Guardian says, knowing most of our proclivities, painstakingly absorb and study and pay attention to these things. Now the, see what other points I should cover here. You'll have some things about combating the forces of darkness. And of course, the very campaigns of the faith are designed to do that. They're offensives against the forces of darkness. We have a prevailing condition. We're trying to change it. We have potentialities and powers and blessings to draw on. We have to become skilled at drawing on them, applying them, attracting, again, the waiting and ready elements in society, and knowing that they're there, trusting that they're there, and find them. I mean, after all, somehow the faith found all of us. And if you think back what you were before you were a Baha'i, you wonder how it ever found us. Well, some of you are Baha'i Zadehs, but even that's not any guarantee of anything. Being born in a Baha'i family is sometimes more challenged. I used to have to talk to the youth in Haifa about that. There's a point where you have to make the faith your own. And there's a point at which you will see, or may see, that your parents' view of the cause is also colored and tainted by the cultural heritage that they come from and by the nature of society around us, and that you have to transcend that somehow. Your parents are thinking, if you're Baha'i just like we are, you'll be fine. But the youth now, sometimes they have a new vision, and they startle us with challenges that they give us about our own lives and about our own attitudes. Part of the process. There was another quotation I wanted to share with you. This is from the Master. He says that the Spirit will come to you with increased force, where your being must become as a temple, the temple of your being, in which truth, the truth of God can dwell. We need to incarnate the Word of God, the truth of God in our beings. The knowledge of God riseth in the heart like the sun, he says, and it will cast an immortal light. He also compares it, he said, this Spirit at first resembles a rivulet, and the earth, when the earth fills the soul. And gradually, as this terrestrial torrent of water rushes through with its living water, it frees the heart from the influence of the earth around it. In another lovely example, he says that the if the earth of one's being moves behind the moon of earthly desires, of lower desires, then the sunlight is eclipsed from the face of the earth. He says you have to move out behind the influence. And of course, it's very seldom that the heart, the earth of our being is behind the moon, but we realize that it can pass out quite quickly again. But sometimes we have those moments of eclipse and we have to transcend those. He says the fruits of the tree of human life are the love of God, magnetic spiritual susceptibilities, heavenly illumination, the knowledge of God, praiseworthy attributes, good morals, and conduct. None, he says, will obtain this great favor, save he who cuts himself from this world, being attracted by the love of God, who is dead to the desires and appetites of self, sincere to God in all things, and meek, humble, imploring, pleading, and lowly before God. The formulas are quite clear. So he's telling us that unless we cut ourselves from the world and become attracted by the love of God, there's no way to free ourselves from the world. There's another example which I'm sure you're all familiar with, but it fits nicely together with this, and that's that the soul starts off like a piece of iron in this world. It is cold, it is dark, and it is hard, solid hard. Through the fire of the love of God, the nature of that iron of our inner being is transformed, and it becomes hot, it becomes radiant, it becomes liquid. All these qualities that we're seeing, Abdu'l-Bahá says, is like the iron when it's submitted to the fire. So the soul, as it's submitted to the love of God, all these older conditions burn out of it, and it attains an entirely new, fresh condition. It doesn't mean that it can't cool off again, and that is usually accompanied by quite a bit of corrosion. So you want to stay in the oven of the love of God. Keep yourself in that attracted state. The quotations that you have to read in the breakout session, I think it would be a good way to focus on a more thorough understanding of these forces of darkness and also on how to combat them. And I think I'll leave you at this point to go on with those breakout studies, and we'll see you again at closing session later in the morning. Thank you very much.